even at the time, before the energy crisis, it was nonsense to do it.
Our building
was clearer that it was wrong to do it.
Our building was designed as though energy is, costs nothing and is unlimited.
Well, but it was worse than that. They did not have the ability to control the dispersion of energy in the building like that. You cannot get the control.
You know that we have had to put out a $30,000 contract to install light switches in our building? The concept was the lights would just be on all the time.
Well, now, did this come out of Albany? There must have been architects involved.
It came out of those architects. That was that our building was done by Smith, Hedgman, and Grills in Detroit. Yours was done by Grusin and Partners.
And there's not a lecture hall on campus that was well known. There are people who know how to do good lecture halls, both terms of acoustics and terms of blackboards and visibility and so on.
That's some nice ones in medical school.
That's another energy monstrosity, energy consuming.
They didn't know how to put the face with that. Look what they did in energy. I mean, it is hard to get an acoustically great hall, but it's pretty easy to get the first approximation. And here in engineering, you see, put poured concrete. I mean, earth space science. So that you can hear everywhere in the room, you just can't understand it.
Remember, at the height of the oyster bay problems, I had a faculty candidate that I took to meet Leonard Olson, and he showed us around Coe Hall, and we were in the Great Hall. Mentioning of the Great Hall reminds me. So we're in the Great Hall, he's looking at that fireplace in the Great Hall, and he says, "Well, you could roast a whole faculty member in there." And Leonard, Olson looked startled, looked at me as though I'd been talking about something.
Giving away the secret.
Okay. Now, anybody else that you can think of on the Stony Brook Council? George?
Yeah, Collins? I think you should include, what's his name?
Anderson?
Anderson, Andy Anderson.
No, what's his name?
What?
Is he around?
Andy Anderson?
Yeah.
I don't know.
How active was Sullivan in his early days?
He's dead.
He died?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Who? Bill Sullivan died.
Oh, yeah.
And apparently threw out all of his correspondence.
Oh, really?
I checked on that.
But Andy Anderson's on the council way back, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yes.
You say he's there?
Well, I'm not sure. I heard about a whole bunch of guys at Brookhaven Lab.
I just heard about one that died. Jim Stangby died. Heard that.
Right. And George Binyard has cancer.
George Binyard has cancer.
Really?
And Art Schwarzschild.
Who?
Art Schwarzschild.
Oh, yeah.
Well, all right. Andy Anderson under the council.
This is getting depressing.
Yes, it is.
That's why it becomes urgent.
Now, other non-faculty, Paul DeMage is right out here on the island.
Yeah, well, he's important.
Very.
You know, and I would recommend that you include one of the Grusin partners, whose name is Thompson.
Thompson.
I forget his first name, but he did a lot on the campus.
Let's see, how can I get a hold of him?
Through Grusin.
Call Grusin. Are they still in Dorton?
I don't know.
The only reason I asked is I think DeMage and Bicarni and Weigel had split up.
Well, DeMage, Bicarni, and Weigel was just a creature.
That was
a construction fund.
Convenience for the
construction. That was just a vehicle, really.
Yeah, they were not partners, really. I saw Paul fairly recently.
Let's see.
You think Charlie Cooper? You got Maurice Crossman. What about Charlie Cooper? He was in a real early stage.
Yes, that would be a good
idea. He's a good man.
I don't know where he is. Does anybody have any idea?
I have no idea.
I don't know.
But I'll ask.
He's some of the central administration right now.
He's still in the civil service, but
yeah. He's a real good pro. I mean, he's one of those people you can really rely on. And he was good.
Now, his predecessor was named Conway.
Oh.
He was a he was a good-hearted character, really.
Yeah.
Frank Conway, right?
Yeah.
I wonder if he's around.
When I came, he was good.
Yeah.
I have a...
He's the one who used to get petty cash out of the cigar.
Yeah, he was, that's right. He was.
And sometimes when there wasn't enough in there, he'd reach in his own pocket and make it out. I never found out. I never asked how that worked.
I just, the thought occurs to me that you might want to include a particular very wonderful secretary named Marge Smith.
Marge Smith. She's at Old Westbury.
She was the secretary for all of us in the sciences in Oyster Bay. And then when we came here, she was chemistry department secretary for quite a few years. And we couldn't get her promoted, so she left. She became assistant to the president of Oyster Bay. She was assistant to Glenn Olds in Old Westbury.
Did you see
what happened to him in Alaska?
Alaska.
What happened?
He ran for Senate
on a Democratic ticket.
And he lost.
Yeah. I got a call from him about 7-8 months ago. He was trying to get a job for somebody.
Now, Marge Smith is now at Old Westbury.
Yes. She's retired.
Well, she may have retired by now.
But I can give you her phone number. Right?
Yeah, all right. But she was working for the president there.
But she was assistant to the president of Old Westbury.
She saw everything.
She knew so much about this whole, about what went on in this place. She was really amazing.
I suppose Ann Jansen is...
Ann Jansen and Mark Smith were close friends.
They're very close. Yeah.
Mark Farnell.
Ann Jansen knew a lot, too. If you could find her, she'd be a very good person to interview.
Okay,
why do you have Eisenbud and Feingold under non-faculty staff?
That's
other.
Other
non-faculty.
It says non-faculty.
Yeah.
I think only that I thought they were retired.
Eisenbud is retired now.
Eisenbud's retired.
Yeah,
Feingold is
retired. They really belong over in the other college.
They do. Right. Ed Feese is retired.
Right.
Okay. And under the faculty, there are not some of the people we met.
There are not, and you should get to the people like, I think, Bill Lister.
Yes, I don't have Bill. Should I get him?
You don't have Cliff Swartz.
Cliff
Swartz.
Cliff.
Yes, and I don't have Tom Irvine.
That's right.
This is frankly,
you've
done off the top of
my head. Yeah, I understand. Of course. Well, Bill Lister, certainly. Harold Ziskin?
Harold,
Ziskin?
You want someone
who... Is he still interviewable?
He's teaching. Although he's, propped up in a bed, kind of wheelchair.
Jay Williams.
He retired.
He's still living around.
But I think he's stricken with advanced senility or something. I don't know.
How long is that?
What?
I think so. That's what I was told.
I said, how long has that been going on?
Oh, well.
It started in 1958.
Yeah. But the one...
Ben Nelson, but he's not here.
No, he's in heaven.
Yes. Possibly.
talking his way still.
Oh, Judah Stanford.
Judah, yes.
Yeah.
He's from
right.
Judah. Also, Joe Pequinny. He's in that group.
Reuben Welch.
And Reuben.
Yes.
That's right. Joe's still over.
I don't have he's still Don Cook.
Don Cook.
do any of you have any feelings about the library and the growth of the library?
No, we were all involved in it. And
but
Reuben's appointment was Don was here first.
Yeah.
But Reuben's appointment was very important in that. He really led the development of the library.
Well, the scholarly commitment that he had was very important.
Very.
Because when we got a group coming in, I remember when I decided to do a kind of dry run before the Middle States came in out. We had the early 70s for our 10-year review, and I wanted to make sure you didn't if we had a problem, we ought to be aware of it. So we had an external group come in to review them, and they were very good librarians, and they said that Reuben really had made a major contribution. Then he had this intuitive sense of scholarly stuff and stuck to his gun. And so even though we didn't have one of the world's great large collections, they were good, solid. In some areas they were quite large, but it wasn't
That's
just
true.
Numbers, it was quality. And that was a very important influence.
I think Reuben was an extremely critical factor. And in our particular department, I appointed Bill Lenoble, library watchdog, in 1959, and he's still doing it. He still is our chief library honcho, and we have a really fine chemistry library. He's really done a superb job.
What about physics?
There's no one person who's not working across the time.
We have Kent first, who's been there forever.
You know, physicists don't use the library very much.
Physicists what?
Don't use the library very much.
They don't get it all at the top of the
list. You have the preprints coming around, and it's important to keep track of those.
And you don't need to know what happened in the past.
I can remember when James Fox used to say, we've got to keep the libraries open. Physicists have to get in at 3 o'clock in the morning when they get these ideas.
That's the way it is.
Or was that Francis Bonner that said it?
What about, what about Roscoe Rouse?
Well, he's kind of left in disgrace. He didn't make much impact, did he?
He had money to spend.
He had a good deal of money. But library committees were very effective, too. Faculty committees in that regard. I remember talking with them. They really kept the pressure on for doing important things to the university.
Carl, are you going to go into students at all, or not?
I'd like to.
There are a number, I think, of the who were there in the first year, many of whom were older than ordinary college students, in their 20s and so forth.
First of whom is Les Paul.
Les Paul, right.
And his wife, Judy.
Yeah, that's his right. Former student.
Paulie
and Judy.
Judy. Who's the president of, has been president of the Alumni Association?
There was one who was president up until a year or two ago, who also was from that group.
He's a lawyer.
I
can't think of his name either. Short, dark.
I think they just got a new one.
Our first graduating class in chemistry was 33% black, 33% female, and 33% wasp.
It's real.
Really.
All right, we want to move over to the questions.
Well, did we, were you through brainstorming about faculty and staff?
Well, I'll go as long as you can think of good ones.
You've been writing them all down as we go.
Well, you could get...
they're there.
Tape.
What?
They're on the tape.
Because I hate to feel that we might be glossing over somebody.
Well, I've got a 65-66 catalog. Mm-hmm.
I have yearbooks that go back to 60 and 61.
Which reminds me, I was up at West Point a few days ago. They invite me back every so often for a ceremony or their physics department ceremony. They were invited to attend the game the next day at the MTS. And I saw the latest yearbook out of West Point. Now, they know how to do yearbooks. They have lots of advertising. Some of our biggest munitions manufacturers is added back with four color ammo. Anyway, it's the same but it's just filled with four color photographs that go out to the edge, all very expensive stuff and so on. And they have a full color picture of the superintendent and the facing page, his message, and then the commandant, and he's a one-star general on his message, and then the dean, who's a one-star general on his message, and you see the way their ranking goes. And the final one is the athletic director. He ranks for the dean. And so the commandant was the one-star general who was charge of the military aspects of the place, spent his entire message to the graduating seniors recounting the story of the message to Garcia. And he had told them this, apparently he reminded them of his final address and so forth. And once again, he wanted to remember that famous story and so forth. And you know the story of the message, Garcia?
I did.
It's all fraud. It was this guy Hubbard out in Western New York who had his own little printing press and made his living by printing homilies of one sort or another circulating. And he found out some of the bare facts of the story of this Cuban war where we intervened earlier on. And made it up on a whole cloth, really. I mean, well, not a whole cloth, because he had a basis for the story about this young lieutenant of the army who was called in by McKinley and said, "We must get a message to Garcia." Now, and then Hubbard goes on, and the moral of the story is he didn't say, "Well, what filing cabinet will I find that in, or who is Garcia, or, you know, that I'm taking a vacation now." What he did was quick as heels to say, "Yes, sir," and off he went to take a message to Garcia. And then the message is now, you being a file clerk for your boss, or you being boss of system. But anyways, this was translated into more languages than anything except the Bible and spread throughout the world in the early 1900s. And made a fortune for others. Well, the actual facts, okay, I mean, the whole thing is stupid. Of course, what he should have done was, to the extent that there was some truth to it, there is, he should try to find out who Garcia was and why and how and so forth. It made a big difference. The actual fact of the matter is they didn't find Garcia until after the war was over.
Now that you've told that story, I'm sorry, but I have to tell a piece of Stony Brook history. And that was in the early 70s, I was the chairman of the Faculty Senate Executive Committee, and Ronald Friend and Dana Bramall were involved in some brouhaha from outside. There were accusations brought against them of bias and admission to psychology, social psychology, PhD.
Somewhat, yeah.
And John Toll was pressing on this, making a big issue out of it, kind of an anti-Bramall and Friend issue. And the Faculty Executive Committee was trying to deal with it. And I assembled a meeting in the Union Building, and we're sitting there around a table discussing this issue. There's a knock on the door, somebody opens the door, and a student messenger comes in and asks for me, hands me an envelope, and then leaves the room. And I open this up, and I take a look, and I see, oh, it's a message from Garcia, who was then the chairman of the psychology.
That's right.
Yeah. I heard that. It was told to me.
It really happened.
Yeah, I know.
It was told to me about it. You were there.
Okay.
Well, oh, well. Yeah.
Now this questionnaire, are you visualizing, you say two department
yes.
chairmen, are you visualizing interviewing a current department chairman?
I wouldn't think necessary. Could be, but this is just the way my mind ran at the time.
Because it takes quite a few questions before it starts to focus on the past, it seems
yeah.
to me.
Yes, I mean, these are identifying questions, identifying the person who's been interviewed.
Right. Places the context very good.
I don't know what you hope to gain by question 9 and the plug word.
That could create a lot of backbiting.
Yeah.
Yes, the
philosophy. Especially if Joe says, who's least?
Some of them will say Aristotle, and others will say.
No, I see your questions for Martha Downey and Charlie Foster.
Yeah. I have appointments for those two.
Well, on this questionnaire concerning faculty staff, Will this be circulated just to the group we have on the page before? Or are you thinking of covering most of the campus on this?
I'm thinking of this as a checklist for some of this can be done over the telephone.
You sure you put the beep on?
Yeah, I have to.
Well, I'd suggest that it's important that you have somewhere a general opening. What your tell us about Stony Brook and the era when you first came here or in the early days. I mean, some very general questions, don't you think? Just an invitation to open up.
And such questions as why did you come to Stony Brook, and at the time you came, what was your understanding of its future and your place in it? What sort of vision did you think there was? Because to a large extent, people who came to those early days came not because of what existed, but because of
what was about to exist.
I think you have questions here that are going to take a lot of time that are not going to really contribute to the historical part of it. Do you see any connection between the quality of student life and the success of the admissions program? I mean, that's a very contemporary question. It always has been a contemporary question. But it still is that's an invitation to say what's wrong now.
Yeah.
And I think you want to keep the what's wrong now questions out, don't you?
Yeah.
And also,
how do you get past, or should you try to get at, the nature of student life, let's say at Manningfields, and the extent of faculty community, feeling of community at Manningfields when it was small?
Now, there wasn't no community when I got there.
No, you know that.
There was no community when I got there.
I said recently.
On the contrary, I think there was a lot of faculty. I mean, maybe you wouldn't say call it community, but the fact of the matter is that we all knew each other. I mean, we went through a long period, including the first few years out here, which you tended to know personally everybody on the faculty. And
you always knew there was going to be a 27-24 vote.
But among whatever. But that meant that you had either 26 or 23 compatriots.
Well, it was like a family. It had its bloody aspects, too. And it was recently Norm Goodman wrote a thing in the Academic News of the Homer essay. And I said to someone, I had to dispute this characterization of the past with the more recent events, and the use of the terminology of Gemeinschaft, Gesellschaft, that the German sociologists used, the basic distinction being that of the sense of intimate community and then formal organizational structure become very bureaucratized. The trouble with that early thing is that it tends to convey to people the sense of harmony and peace and good spirit. You see, guys jumped out of bushes to hit you. I mean, and the same part as there, it was a double-edged sword. People knew it, but at the same time, it was a very ideological struggle was taking place. You said there was a kind of personal tragedy for some people happening all the time because they came also with expectations. You see, the interesting thing is that a whole group of people came with certain expectations. In a real sense, that they were never to be realized for them. They came to the wrong place. For many of us, it was
they were here, and many of them were here first.
Exactly, they were the Indians, and they sort of have felt. Well, I knew some were very bitter. Of course, there was a period of
those who left did.
Some left
those
in that
who
group.
Could leave did.
Yes, some in that group.
Well, and a number had full professorships and stayed.
They stayed, and they're still here. They stayed to this day. And,
and never fully reconciled to what we're, and basically some of them very unhappy people.
But Tom, you had a good sense of community with the physicists and the chemists and Bradfield, lots of people.
Oh, sure, yeah. I misunderstood the question. I thought it was a community of students and faculty.
Well,
well
now, the students in the very first year still feel that way about the experience.
The students feel that way, yeah.
They were all taking the same course, or courses,
yeah.
And had a small number of faculty and knew all of them.
Yeah, that's true.
Sort of the first and second, third grade.
I got a very strong reaction about wanting to have commencement back at
Oyster
Bay on the part of, this was the second graduating class of 63, no, it was the third graduating class, 63, and the fourth graduating class, 64. We had two commencements back at Oyster Bay.
Which one was it that we had all pioneers?
We had the
third one, right? It went on for a while, didn't it?
All pioneers.
Frank Hurt.
Conducted by Frank Hurt.
Yeah.
Do you remember the...
don't forget to put
Frank Hurt. Yeah, don't forget to put Frank Hurt.
Oh, yeah. The students asked...
Should be.
Asked representatives from the three divisions of human knowledge. The natural sciences, the humanities, and the social studies. They wanted a general talk by a representative from each. I know Harold Ziskin gave one, I suppose, for the matter. I can't think of the other one. And then I gave one for the sciences. And we had such a whole student body out there, I think most of the faculty. And I was the third one to come along. And the first two, we had heard endlessly about the Greeks and their writings on Aristotle, etc. Socrates and so on. And anyways, I had occasion in leading off what I was going to say something about the Republic that I brought it. And characterized it as being, I forgot the exact word, but essentially utter nonsense unless you took it seriously, in which case it was obscene. And in the front row you could see a whole row of faculty getting pale. As if I had had a bunch of Baptist ministers who said something bad about the Bible or something.
Oh, yeah.
I actually believe that about the Republic.
Yeah. Sacred soil.
Carl, I don't think these questions are freewheeling enough.
I don't think so. That's too specific.
Yeah.
I think.
I mean, if you ask me these questions, I get a little irritated.
I think your first eight questions identify the the people. I mean, you want to know who they are.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
I think that first eight or so questions do that. And then I agree with Tom, it should be worth freewheeling.
Okay. What kind of questions would you ask?
Business about why did you come
expectations.
Here?
Expectations.
With what vision? What did you hope?
What were your expectations?
And ending up with them. How did it work out? Both personally and for the institution.
Yeah. Tell us about your early experiences.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just get them talking.
That's right.
Just get them talking.
And what
the way we've been doing this.
Right.
And from their point of view, what they regard as the most significant experiences they encountered here. So what were the things that they had time they'd like to talk about when,
I thought maybe I was getting at that under 11.
I think 11 is, that's kind of a taking your temperature for the present. I don't see that as a historical question, as an invitation to discuss the historical past. Do you? Am I?
No, I think you want to get people talking about their experiences.
But you're saying, what are the advantages of being at Stony Brook now? I mean, it's...
Okay. All right.
One of the things I had suggested, I don't know, when the question came about writing a history, when Mom Berger told me this little thing,